This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are we entering the age of super forest fires? Our guest is John Betts, Executive Director of the Western Silvicultural Contractors Association. He's in British Columbia, Canada, in the gorgeous lakeside town of Nelson, BC. John, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Is there a potential for super fires in British Columbia?
Yeah, I think there is a potential, and to kind of answer your question, not to shorten the interview by any regards, but I think we've already entered the era of super fires both in Canada, continental U.S., Australia, and other areas as well.
Well, why do you say that?
Well, what we're beginning to see are fires of unusual intensity, severity, frequency, and so on, occurring in different forest types across the world. Again, I'm most familiar with what's occurring here in BC and in parts of the U.S., but certainly we're seeing the same tendency in Australia. The other thing that adds more severity to these and sort of brings with it a whiff of catastrophe is the fact that human habitat has been encroaching into these forest ecosystems, which are in a certain, we'll talk about a little later, but they're in a not a great state to begin with. And once you begin to embed human habitat like homes and so forth, as well as infrastructure like watersheds and transmission corridors, quite a lot of values are at stake. And so we're seeing loss of infrastructure and lives as well, and communities are being destroyed by wildfire on a scale we haven't seen before either.
Well, so what is new about these fires? We've had fire for centuries. What's new about these?
Well, I referred to intensity and severity. So those are, I don't want to dwell too much on the technicalities of it, but the intensity refers to the energy a fire releases, and severity is the duration, to put it simply, the damage it does in the duration of time it spends burning. What we're seeing, because of the available fuels, and this is a term I'm going to come back to this, because there's so much more wood on the landscape to burn, we're seeing fires burn, as I said, with more energetically, with longer durations, with increasing frequency, and also spreading at quite higher rates than we've typically seen. So fire behavior in many locales around the planet has changed significantly. Plus, these fires are beginning to take on a capacity to be destructive, not only to the communities that we have built in them, but they actually are starting to damage the ecosystems that they are part of themselves. They're actually doing long-term damage to the habitat. These fires are burning well out of the sort of normal range of variability that we might see.
Right. You told Justine Hunter of the Globe and Mail newspaper these fires can burn so hot they actually sterilize the ground. Does that mean nothing much grows back there for a while, or not a forest, or what?
That can occur, and it has to do with the structure of the fuels. In other words, just exactly what is catching fire. I think I need to step back a bit to explain just how that can occur. And I'll use BC as an example. We've had an outbreak here of the mountain pine beetle, which has affected approximately 15 million hectares, or close to about, say, twice that in terms of acres. So 30 million acres of land has been either degraded or destroyed, meaning the standing trees are pretty much all dead, across a huge area of British Columbia. So what happens then is those trees stand for some time, maybe depending on the location and the weather and so forth, but then about 10 years they start to break down. I mean, obviously they dry out and desiccate, they crack and they check, the bark comes off, other little bugs and beetles get in there after the mountain pine beetle. It's a bit of a heyday maybe for woodpeckers for a while, but basically the stand then begins to break down and fall into itself. It may lean up against other trees, or if they're alive, if it's a mixed stand, it may lean up against live trees, or they fall onto the ground and form a kind of a jackstrawed matrix of fuel. Well, that area then, that creates, if you can picture that in your mind, when that catches on fire, and you've all built bonfires and so forth and figured out when you sort of stack your sticks in a certain way, you can get a really good fire going. Well, I'm oversimplifying some, but the gist of it is the fuel is across a large portion of the landscape here and in many other parts of continental U.S. and other parts. The fuel is now structured to burn quite differently than it would normal if it was a normal standing forest. So, and when that happens, the fires burn for a long time, and the heat is radiated down into the soil, and it's in that soil that all the little enzymes, bacteria, seeds, and so forth that under a normal healthy fire regime would simply re-sprout and come back actually get killed off.
Well, as you say, this isn't just a problem for British Columbia. People from Colorado all the way to Australia, even Spain, face the threat of superfires. John Betts, you were just at a fire meeting. Can you tell us what it was and some of the things that you heard there?
Well, our association, the Western Silvicultural Contractors Association, hosted a major international wildfire conference in Kelowna, British Columbia, just a few weeks back. And what we did was we brought speakers in, experts in the wide range of areas of interest around communities and wildfire. And we brought speakers from Australia, United States, Canada, British Columbia. And they spoke to a wide range of issues. Our purpose here was to make British Columbians aware, and particularly community leaders, to appreciate the problem that we're seeing grow on the landscape right now. I think there's still some simplistic thinking, which is forgivable given the weight of responsibilities that municipal and provincial governments have upon them. But the notion that we can deal with wildfire as we have done traditionally through suppression, and that's all we need to do about it. Well, of course, what we're seeing in these fires, and it's been certainly some of the people who are saying this loudest are the suppression people, is that these are fires that we really can't put out. So to rely on suppression as a way of protecting neighborhoods and all the infrastructure I just described, both community-related as well as industries that are embedded in the forest as well, we need to be thinking of different strategies to how we manage the land. To put it simply, we need to take the fuel out of the forest that's going to contribute to these catastrophic wildfires. And that was the purpose of the conference, was to expose people to all the various aspects of this. I mean, we covered everything from home insurance, like what effect are catastrophic wildfires having on the home insurers in the U.S., and will that travel up to Canada? Will those same effects be held here? We talked about what kind of buildings need to be built and what materials need to be used and what do you have to do around your own house or in your community, and what needs to be done out on the landscape to mitigate the effects of these hazardous, these very dangerous wildfires. So we covered quite a lot of ground. We tracked it over 200 individuals from across BC, Alberta, far away actually as Australia as well, who have an interest in this topic. So we think this kind of discussion needs to really happen, because the remedies are going to be found not just in protection and emergency response, but in what programs do we undertake to remove the fuels that are threatening communities. How do we pay for that? Is there value in the biomass that we're removing? Could that possibly be used to heat schools or create bioenergy fuels? What kind of creative responses do we need to that? And, you know, a whole range of issues. We wanted to emphasize that to deal with wildfire threat, we need to take a holistic approach.
Right. Well, the old theory of forest management, and it was pushed by parks management and some greens as well, was just leave that fallen wood as part of the cycle of building forest soils. Your association does have an interest in changing that to remove more of the dead wood and the undergrowth. Is that right?
Yes. And, you know, but it's interesting to remark that in the national forests in BC and Alberta have very active programs of managing for wildfire, which include removing trees. Heaven forbid, I'm not going to say the word logging in the parks. But they've realized that they have a huge problem there in terms of the fact that many of the landscapes there have been denied fire. I should go back and emphasize that one of the primary causes of this threat is the fact that we've been suppressing fire effectively for quite a few decades. And the outcome of that is that the forests have missed their normal cycles of fire. So now when we get fires, and there's no reason to believe we're not going to have them, they tend to burn, as I said, with intensities and severities and frequencies we have not seen before. So rather than risk the parks going up in smoke in the worst way possible, they're doing a combination of things. In some cases, they're lighting fires to simply reintroduce fire into the landscape. In some cases, they're coming in and thinning trees out and removing excess vegetation with the idea of, in fact, opening up grazing land that was lost to some of the ungulates that live in the parks because the trees have encroached on them because of the fire suppression. So we're seeing some of the most cutting-edge approach actually coming from the national parks. So there's a difference between some woody biomass needed to replenish the soil and removing the fuels that are, in fact, capable of destroying the soils.
Well, the fire threat can be terrifying when it reaches towns or cities. Could you tell our listeners about some of the incidents that have happened in British Columbia?
Well, of course, our conference was done in a sense to, I was going to use the word celebrate, but I guess that's not the right word, to remember the 2003 fires in Kelowna. And that was a very significant event, maybe a turning point in our appreciation of wildfire, although I have sometimes reasons to doubt whether we've really learned everything we needed. But we lost a couple of hundred homes in that neighborhood. We lost others in other communities, Barriere, north of Kelowna. We've lost some in the East Kootenays. It was a very bad year that year. But it's well worth noting that in just the Okanagan alone, in fact, just last year, there was a fire in a small community across from Kelowna called Trepanier Creek, which nearly destroyed, well, it did destroy part of that community, a very fast-moving, wind-driven fire that had an effect, nearly took out a shopping plaza and a number of homes and so on. So, and it behaved very differently than what we've expected. So we continue to see fires of that kind of severity and potentially catastrophic on a regular basis. Of course, in Alberta, Slave Lake is a huge fire event that everyone, I think the 40% of that community was destroyed by fire, and they're still rebuilding that community today. And of course, down in Colorado, to draw attention back there, because there are some very strong parallels between Colorado and some of the forest types we have here. They had a dreadful year just last year in Colorado Springs and the Waldo Canyon fire and so forth, where we saw, again, hundreds of homes destroyed in what would look, most of us would think were suburbs. They didn't obviously seem to be really embedded in the forest to the extent that we might think of when we normally talk about, you know, communities that are built into the forest. So we've got a history here. It goes back, I think, in 1998 in BC, we had our first big warning. There was a fire near Salmon Arm. And it, what it did is it spotted sparks some few kilometers down into the community. And that's another thing that we need to be well aware of. Your neighborhood may not be right up against the woods, but the thing that tends to destroy communities are the burning embers. And some of them, we know, have blown 3-4 kilometers, and I've heard unconfirmed reports that they might even sometimes carry twice that distance. So they're capable of starting fires just by spotting. And we've seen that in a kind of a quiet little fire a few years ago up in the north of BC called the Binta Lake Fire. And then as a cold front pushed through, a cold low front pushed through, which it turns out is very conducive to creating big wildfires, that fire moved 20 kilometers in one day. So if you put that into the fire shed that I live in here in Nelson, which is an east-west valley, which is the way the winds tend to blow, that's a pretty scary phenomenon to see happen. And frankly, where I live, we've got woods built up, or that I wouldn't say that's out of the range of possibility.
Yeah, I've seen video in California where the fire just races over the hill out of sight before you can snap your fingers practically, and no human's going to get in there in time to stop it. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm talking with John Betts from the Western Silvicultural Contractors Association in Canada. And John, when I visited some communities surrounded by these dead pine forests, the discussion quickly turns to metal roofs for the very reason that you just brought up. Those dropping embers can start a fire right in the town. Should we be cutting down trees for fire breaks around the towns and cities? That's a very hot debate right now.
Well, I pick my words carefully here. You may have to take some trees down, but it doesn't mean you have to denude the landscape. But let's go back to what you just said about the homes. Let's face it, in many cases, you look at the pictures, you'll often see the homes are burnt down, but the adjacent trees haven't. So the inference you can draw from that is that that home was more flammable and more prone to catching on fire than the actual adjacent trees. So I think the first thing you've got to do is make sure that you've got fireproof roofs. And metal roofs are one example, but there are all kinds of different materials that can be used. And in fact, going back to Colorado and the fires I mentioned in the Waldo Canyon, tens of thousands of roofs have been changed in those neighborhoods and are continuing to be changed. So you've got to make your house, to some extent, fire adapted. So you change the roof. You've got to clean your eaves out, too. Again, the eaves and valleys of your roof tend to accumulate materials. You can find out how to do all this through programs like in Canada, it's called Fire Smart Canada. In the United States, you can go to FireWise Communities or Fire Adapted Communities Coalition. Both of those programs are well known, and you can learn about what you can do to your own home. The community then needs to take some responsibility for what is the best thing to do around your neighborhood. Then that's where you got into sort of having to decide. You need to have fire experts come in. It isn't just, like I said, a question of cutting down every tree, but you're going to have to look at slope aspect, the previous fire history, the grasses. Remember that the other thing about cutting trees down is that within 4 or 5 years, things grow back up. So there's a kind of a long-term strategy. So it would be simplistic to say cutting trees down, but you need to actively manage the landscape around your community. And that could involve a number of things. Basically, what I'm saying here is that we can learn to live with fire if we design our communities in the right way and if we design our homes in the right way, and we also get active even further out on the landscape to modify, create fire fuel breaks, if you will, through how we log, how we harvest, and so forth, and begin to make it so the fire can actually pass through a neighborhood, and we can simply, I'm oversimplifying a bit, but return to it and find that the neighborhood isn't destroyed, the trees aren't all gone, there's been a fast-moving fire that we knew was coming, got out of the way, are able to keep our homes from burning down, and actually learn to live with every few years fire coming through if you're in an active fire management area, and of course the frequency and return intervals would differ depending on the forest types and climate and so forth.
And I guess, too, some of it may be just really consider whether you want to go off and live in the woods. As you mentioned, some of the suburbs are expanding into areas and some people are building way back. Maybe your choice of where you're going to live could be important if the regime is changing.
Yeah, and now the insurance industry in the U.S., which hasn't really taken a whole lot of interest in wildfire compared to what they lose through tornadoes and hurricanes and other calamities. But they're starting to pay close attention to this, and that's one indicator that, just along the lines you said, Alex, that people are going to have to start thinking about when you move in, when you bring your flush toilet, if you will, out to the wilderness and park your home out there and start up your lawnmower, remember, you're in a fire-based ecosystem. And, you know, you have a right to live there, but you got a duty to sort of figure out what that means. And that may mean that you can't have the nice pine tree hanging over top of your porch or your roof. It may mean that you've got to think about whether that you're actually in a healthy forest and is there some things you can do to make it healthier. And that's a really important view to have. Because we've interrupted the natural cycles of disturbance, because we're experiencing we seem to have the symptoms of global warming at play, which is just sort of adding fuel to the fire, we need to be taking all of those things into consideration and learning also. We've introduced ourselves. We're well embedded in this. With that goes a responsibility to sort of live intelligently on the land, figure out whether your home is fire adapted. Don't be reliant on simply being bailed out by helicopters full of fire retardant. Take responsibility for your landscape and your expectations in that area.
Well, John, you raised global warming, and I know that you end up talking to mill owners and workers and loggers. Do they generally understand the role of global warming in the pine bark beetle, that the winters just are too warm and didn't kill them off, or do they still consider it some kind of green plot? What's your take on that?
I think people to be honest with you, I don't think global warming has actually played its hand yet. Yes, we've had a series of warm years where the beetle was allowed to survive in numbers we don't normally see, and that's an important factor. But I'm saying in a way that the landscape was about to sort of give out in some respect. Either it was going to be the mountain pine beetle or huge fires or something, because we had allowed the forest to depart so far from their normal regime. If you add global warming to this, and I think people understand that some people take the mountain pine beetle as a literal expression of global warming. I'm taking a more nuanced view, but what I'm saying is certainly the longer fire seasons, like we're adding 30 days to our fire seasons in parts of BC, clearly there's a trend going on here, and I don't think anyone's denying that. And in fact, I would say that the lumber logging industry has a very strong interest in fully understanding wildfire, global warming, and the effects it's going to have on their ability to simply harvest wood off this landscape.
Do you think we're going to be able to adapt our silviculture and maintain the ecology of forests and the business of forestry, even if we get, you know, these record high heats as they did in Australia, for example?
I'm afraid I'm being cast so many times as the sort of fatalistic prophet of doom, but let me switch channels briefly. We have still a window to do intelligent things on the landscape. There are moments when it seems the pace of events, the catastrophic events, seem to really be able to, as you mentioned, that fire that went across the horizon before we could notice it. Clearly, I think there are times when I wonder if we're going to keep up. But I think there are things that we can do, and we can start at our home, we can spread out through our communities, we can at least begin to make sure that our neighborhoods and watersheds, and I use the term fire shed, are protected. We can start with that. And I think out of that, I'm going to be optimistic, which is untypical, but I think we can actually generate an economy around reducing the hazard that currently we face in the forests in many of the parts of the world. And that we can take some of that biomass that I'm saying needs to be removed and convert it, as I said earlier, into the economy as to make products. Maybe that would then overcome the biggest obstacle here is how do you pay for all of this work that needs to be done to undo the consequences of how we've managed our forests to date. It's a huge debt, but there may be ways to do it. And I have to take the optimistic view, because as you mentioned in the outset, I do live in a very nice place on the shores of Kootenay Lake, and I have a vested interest personally in not going up in smoke. And I'm hoping that if we can get other communities and individuals and leaders, both at the state, federal, provincial levels, to take leadership on this, we can actually save the economy a lot of money. Because one of the consequences of fire is that you may hear sums of hundreds of millions of dollars being spent to suppress fire. But the long-term costs of fire are in many cases, as studies now show, 10, 20, 30 times that. If you blow out a major watershed to a major community, the consequences of that to rebuild that infrastructure artificially is huge. If you are beset with the degradation of the landscape so that you have floods and mudslides and so on, the cost of that, the health costs, the interruptions to the economy, the long-term consequences, which I don't even know how you put a measurement on, of having destroyed ecosystems, when you've actually burned an area off to the point where the only thing that can come in is opportunistic invasive plants, how do you put a cost on that? So there are huge costs that are associated with this, and I'm taking the view that I'm hoping that we can get out ahead of this. I'd say we've got 10, 15 years, and after that, I would not be so optimistic.
And I'm thinking most of these dead forests are going to burn, releasing more gigatons of carbon into the atmosphere. Do you think most of it will burn? And if you had to make a guess, when would the years of the giant forest fires come?
You know, if you go back to Yellowstone in 1988, I think that was 300,000 hectares. That was the equivalent of three times in one fire, three times what we would normally burn in all of British Columbia. And British Columbia could easily hold the state of Texas with a lot of room left over inside. So it gives you a sense of the size of it. We've already seen huge fires already. And it was interesting that certainly mountain pine beetle degraded forests were a factor in the Yellowstone fire. So if I'm saying that British Columbia and other large swathes of the landscape throughout continental U.S. and so on, at least in the coniferous forests, are subject to the same thing, it could happen as soon as 6 weeks or 2 months from now here in Canada when we enter sort of into the drying trend. If the jet stream sets up there in within 3 or 4 weeks, by just July or August, I hate to sound like this, but it's the truth, Alex, we are in a position to have terrifically huge wildfires after about 6 weeks of dry weather here in British Columbia and in many other places.
I think it could come this year or next year, in the next several years. It more or less has to happen. That's just my opinion. You know, last spring I interviewed one of Canada's top fire experts, Dr. Michael Flanagan from the University of Alberta, and he told us that further north, the soil is so thin, it only takes 3 hot days to reach high fire risk, even after a period of heavy rains. 3 days, the forest can burn. How does that compare with your experience further south?
Yeah, you'd have to talk to fire behavior experts, but my understanding here is the lighter fuels do dry out very quickly. They can then carry fire quite well. So the larger fuels take a little longer to dry out, obviously. But the way things are configured here in BC, let's just say if we went through a cycle like we did a decade or so ago where we had about 4 or 5 years of relatively dry years. And then I think that, after El Nino and these sort of effects, the dryness tends to accumulate, especially if you go back to that fuel matrix I described earlier where the wood is kind of stacked. In some cases, that wood isn't even covered in the snow. So, and no one's going to, we haven't really quantified this in any manner that I can understand, but it may, like I said, fire experts can perhaps help you with that question. But I'm saying that it doesn't take much to burn here, and it isn't the same fire type. But I mentioned the Trepanier fire in back in near Kelowna just last year. That fire moved very quickly on a very light fuel load that was largely pine needles underneath a closed canopy of lodgepole pine. With the wind and the dry needles, that was produced a very dangerous fire that moved very quickly into a neighborhood. So we are seeing, as I said, fire behavior that we've never quite anticipated and are just beginning to try to figure out the models to predict. So we're straying into some unknown territory here, but the balance of probability is in favor of anyone that wants to say we're going to, as I have been saying, see increasingly large fires, increasingly frequent fires, increasingly intense and severe, and the catastrophic outcomes will be felt in many areas, economically, socially, and so forth, and they will be enduring. This is one of our largest challenges I think we face, in British Columbia. Much is being said about the timber down shortfall and so forth. But, and there, in the past, we used to fight over things around parks versus clear cuts. This is a challenge of such complexity on such a scale that some of the old positions and the old thinking really isn't a match for it. And we're going to have to find new ways of approaching these problems.
We have been talking with John Betts, Executive Director of the Western Silvicultural Contractors Association in British Columbia, Canada. You can find links to his organization and some of the stories we've been discussing in my show blog at ecoshock.info. John, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.